Hey guys, this is Ishai Breslauer and welcome to the CRE Shark Eye Show, where we discuss commercial real estate. On Mondays, we dive deep into an asset class, and on Thursdays, we go into some inspirational stories for the weekend. Can't wait to start. Let's go. Hi guys, this is Ishai Breslauer with the CRE Shark Eye Show. I hope you guys are doing fantastic. And today we have a very, very special guest, very, very special guest. And I'll tell you why. His name is Peter Lewis. He's the chairman and president of Wharton Equity Partners and vast experience in real estate and a lot of asset classes. And today he's involved in one of the hottest sectors, which is industrial. And we're going to dive deep and talk about this. But first of all, his story is really unique. And we're going to talk about that, and we want to get to meet him. So first of all, Peter, thank you for being on the show. Really appreciate your time.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you for inviting me. Yeah, great.
100%. You know what? I saw a bunch of stuff. I saw a bunch of things where you spoke, and your story is really unique, how you got into real estate, how you sort of got into this thing. And I think this is a very inspiring story. Would you care to share it with us a little bit, how it all began?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because when I started my career, you know, I went to undergraduate at University of Pennsylvania, Wharton School, and then graduated at Columbia Business School. I was a finance and accounting major. I didn't really even know what real estate was. I mean, I'm one of three brothers. I'm the middle one. And when I grew up, the joke was I didn't know what a hammer was. I mean, I was always delegated that. I was always a good delegator. Both my brothers were very handy, so I always kind of gave them the task of fixing things up around the house while I went out and played basketball. So it is ironic that I'm the one who wound up in real estate. And like a lot of things in life, it was propitious how it happens. When I graduated business school, I wound up working for a tax accounting firm, a large firm at the time called the Big Eight accounting firm. And I really didn't like accounting, public accounting. I just felt it wasn't entrepreneurial enough for me. And I got recruited to go down to Wall Street and wound up in an investment banking group where I started doing, getting exposed to real estate investment banking and started seeing the money that we were giving to developers and investors, and I met these guys, and I kind of said, you know, I can do what they're doing. And naively, thankfully, at the ripe old age of 28, I jumped down on my own and started my career. And as I alluded to, you know, many times you're better off not knowing what you don't know, because if you know too much, you're not going to take the step. So that's a lesson to be learned right away, that you'll figure things out if you have the desire. And so I wound up going out and tying up a shopping center site on the South Shore of Long Island in an area called Islip, and was successful in taking it through the approval process. It was a development site, as I mentioned, and we wound up flipping that site before we closed, or concurrent with the closing, and made a lot of money, and that launched the career. And so early in my career, I wound up being a developer of multifamily, mostly for sale housing in the tri-state area, becoming one of the larger developers of residential, fully integrated from construction through sales through punch lists and then managing. And I learned from the ground up, literally, how to be a developer. And I was out there at 6 a.m. yelling at the subs, making sure that that our subs got there, making sure our guys got paid. My parents, my Jewish parents were in shock because I had spent all this money to go to these fantastic institutions in finance and accounting. And here I was running around in sneakers, you know, and a sweatshirt. And my mother fainted almost when she saw me on the job site once. She thought I'd be in a tie and suit working at Goldman Sachs. I loved it. I loved the creativity of it. I loved the pressure. I loved all about it. And when I started my career, which is interesting, I think, for some of your listeners, I didn't have a track record. I had a little bit as an investment banker, but I was still young. And how you pull together money and how you convince lenders to give you money, because we started building homes. Our first project was on Long Island. And this was right after the downturn. So this was the early 90s. This was a while back. but the world was still recovering from the horrific downturn in the late 80s, early 90s. And we wound up convincing a bank called Long Island Savings Bank to lend us money. And we were fortunate enough to pull together from friends and family a few million dollars, and that launched the business. But you have to have complete conviction. Just a quick aside on that particular project, again, 1991, the world was horrific still. No new projects had been built. People were giving their houses back. Banks were going under. And we wound up buying basically a note from a bank on a project. And we had a long due diligence period. And we wound up putting ads in the paper at that time, Penny Saver, saying homes for sale. And we sold the price. And we waited to see if we'd get any phone calls. We hadn't closed on the property yet. And when the phone started ringing off the hook, I looked at my partner and I said, we're building this project. And we wound up building a great project, which was our first, as I mentioned, in an area called Syosset on Long Island. And from there we went on. So ultimately what happened is I built a business of some size in residential. And at some point, what happens is when you start getting bigger, particularly residential, well, development in general around the tri-state area gets harder and harder as you look for bigger projects, because most of the towns that you want to be in don't want you. Development is very tough. Residents are tough. It's hard to find kind of land that you can scale on. So ultimately we came at an inflection point, which said, do we want to stay in our market, or do we want to go to Arizona or North Carolina and start building big projects? And we just decided not to go, far away. And so we shifted our focus to income producing properties. And that left us on a journey of going into self-storage, which was a business that I had learned when I was on Wall Street. We were one of the firms that helped launch a firm today called Public Storage. And I watched that business and I said, this is the greatest business ever. I mean, you ever walk through these facilities, you have one woman up front playing cards, and otherwise it's all quiet when you walk through there and people pay their rent. If they don't, you lock their locker and, get rid of their stuff. So, we built a very big business in self-storage way before it became an institutional asset class. And my theory was if we could, one of the problems with self-storage is, generally speaking, each transaction on it is small. But if you could bulk it up, there will be a lot of institutional buyers that would buy it. This is similar to what's happening today in industrial and some other asset classes. And so we wound up doing that, and we were fortunate. We owned most of the self-storage in the Hamptons, which we aggregated over a period of number of years from individual owners, and we wound up selling that to a REIT. And then we repeated the same thing. We bought a lot of major warehouses around New York City from GE Capital, which had a lot at that time, and we sold that to a big insurance company.
Okay, I'm sorry, I'm stopping you. There's so much great information here, and I want to sort of dissect it. First of all, just to let you know that I heard you with Michael Stoller, I'm telling you, and we have a lot more things in common than you think, meaning you have some sources in Great Neck. I know that you were there.
Right. I grew up there.
I lived in Great Neck. I know that you grew up in your Jewish experience as a kid, and et cetera, your love for music and basketball. So we share a lot of loves, I would call it. things that we love to do. I would one thing that is I'm really curious about, really, really curious about, because I know a lot of guys and gals, okay, today that do that are focused on commercial real estate for many, many years and have vast experience in this field. And it's something that I see all the time. That people who are focused on an asset class, for example, a person who does multifamily, core plus, or, income producing, conservative, whatever, the second you speak to him about development, they're like, it's a risky business. Don't do it ever, If you see a developer that does condos, the second you talk to him about office, he's like, office is terrible. The second you see a guy who does retail, office is terrible, this is terrible, and vice versa. And you have managed to sort of cross through all those. And my question to you is, and I would like to go with it one by one. You started with I would call it, you know, the residential aspect, right? More condo development. But diving deep into the development aspect of things, and as a guy who did development also involved in it, it takes so much to get development done. So much, the team has to be so perfect, and you have to be on top. And you could be less hands-on. You could be more of a developer, having a GC or a CM that takes care of the GC, as we call it, and have all these hierarchies and puts you more as a, you know, bird's eye view position. And then you have the hands-on position. Can you talk a little bit about the hands-on position versus the, you know, the bird's eye view position, what you took and what you believe in?
Yeah, look, you can't, you must have good talent. Every business that we've been in, I've hired people who have vastly more experience than I have. So when we started building houses, we plucked the guy out of a firm that was building 10,000 houses a year in New Jersey, you know, and he became a key part of our construction team. So he reported to me, but I have enough business sense to understand how things work. And over time I learned how to build, but I always had guys like him in the firm. So the key, I think, to my success of being able to navigate through these different asset classes is talent and the ability to gauge talent and to motivate them and keep them happy. Being a people person is essential to doing what I do. And because of that, I see no boundaries to anything that I've ever tried to do. And in some ways, it's a little bit of a curse because everything's in play. You know, sometimes you might be better off just having a very narrow focus, which you talked about. Let's say I'm a multifamily guy that just buys buildings in the Bronx. You know, I never viewed the world in that regard. I always thought about what's the right opportunity at the right time, and looking ahead as to whether or not that opportunity is going to mature into something that I think would be fruitful. So whether it was self-storage, which I felt was early, but there, I could sense the appetite from institutions, whether it was, and we'll get to this a little later, but our movement into Miami in 2012, 2013, while the world was still, Miami had 30,000 unsold condo units, and I sensed that it was turning, and we made a move there. And you know, whether we're doing industrial, again, we had no industrial experience as of late 2017. Today we have many millions of square feet, and I'll tell you how that happens. So I think the answer to your question is hiring great talent. You don't need a lot of them, but you need great talent. And then on top of all this, you have to have a just complete passion to win. If you don't have that, then everything else is irrelevant, because inherent in that passion to win is a crazy obsession with having to know. You know what I'm saying? And exactly. having to know doesn't fall all on me. It's having to find guys that know and then having them talk to me, versus me bypassing that guy and talking directly to the mason that's telling me it's 32 degrees and we need to add certain ingredients into the foundation because otherwise it'll, you know, crack. Like, I wouldn't have known that. So, again, I think the whole thing is a combination of hiring great talent, but I think a very high level, just as I take a step back in my career, what's made us successful across time and asset classes and strategies is a understanding of where things are going. And I talk a lot on this. I'm lecture at Columbia Business School and other places, and you know, I'm asked the question often, how do you know these things? How do you feel these things? And really what it becomes is being in tune with changes, really trying to focus on when I'm reading things. If I read something in the Wall Street Journal, I don't just take it at face value saying, oh, you know, there's money that just went into a new electric car company. You know, I look at like, okay, so what does this mean? Now, you know, what's electric vehicles going to mean to the real estate world? What's that mean going to mean to garages? What's that going to mean to think about driverless trucks. What's that going to mean to where distribution facilities are going to be in the future? Because trucks can go all night long without, there's no driver, right? They don't have to go for a potty break. So the way I'm constructed is not taking the world at face value and just reading the headlines. I always thought about underneath it, how do I take advantage of this? And if you live that way and you're a student of that change, then you become part of that change and figuring things out. And I have a whole idea on where things are going from here, which if we have a few minutes,
we'll get to that. And that's, first of all, I love that perspective. Hey guys, before we continue, I would like to introduce you to the 7-day CRE challenge, which will introduce you to commercial real estate and will show you that anyone can do this. Also, I have the free cheat sheet for commercial real estate with the 6 best secrets for commercial real estate. You can download it free. Just click below or above, wherever it is, and get it. Let's continue. I want to get into for a second. So you were in residential, right? And then you pivoted to storage. What was the first thing you did?
Storage.
What was the point that you said, I am going into storage? What did you see there and then and there that said to, that told you, you looked in the mirror and said, I'm now moving to storage? What was that?
I think it was a conclusion as to where I felt housing was going for our firm. And so, as I mentioned, our staff was getting bigger. We needed to do bigger jobs. But also I started realizing that for the business angle that we were in, which is really for sale housing, it's ordinary income because you're a dealer. You have contingent liabilities when you leave communities because homeowners always hire a lawyer who comes after you for defects, even if there aren't any, and they're uncontained, you know, I mean, they get a contingency in 30%, whatever they, you know, extract from the developer. So you're constantly leaving behind money in communities and you have these contingent liabilities. So when we started layering in, there wasn't a lot of big land left to do the kind of deals that I wanted to do. The last deal I did was $125 million of sales, and that was in, you know, let's say in the 90s. So what would that be today? Wow. Over 200 million. So it's a big job, right?
Yeah.
It's hard to find those today.
Very hard.
And so I knew that if I started thinking about a 20-year career ahead of me, I'd have to make a move geographically to continue this. And I didn't love the business enough to make that decision. So I said, you know what, we're not doing this. And I called back on in my mind what was happening with self-storage. Again, having been an early analyst and an observer of that business, because back when I was on Wall Street, which was in the 80s, self-storage was 20 years old. It's an infant business compared to the rest of the real estate world.
That's true.
Who would have thought that people, you get paid to keep crap in people's lockers? I mean, it's like the stupidest thing in the world, but it's a big business. So I saw it coming. And so when I started, and I said it, and it was easy. That was the other thing. Because
what's,
didn't know much
what's easy about it? What's more easy about storage when you talk about it? Because housing, everybody talks about housing and they say, okay, that's the easiest asset class because everybody lives there. And to calculate it, it's like sort of, you know, given. Why is storage in your eyes easier?
When you get a tenant, generally speaking, they stay for a while, at least a year. And they're very sticky. And they pay through ups and downs because they have personal possessions in there that their grandmother gave them that they don't want to lose. So and they're very, very light management. Think about it. There are rows and rows of lockers. So you don't have
nobody ever gets there, right?
No, you know, leaky faucets. You know, you're not worried about packages disappearing. You know, like it's a very, and today with technology, it's even easier. You know, there's a world now coming where you won't have any people on these sites and it'll be all managed either, you know, remotely from you know, through the internet. But so I thought that was really interesting. And so what we did, because I knew the business, but I didn't know the business as an owner, is that we started going to the self-storage conventions. So we got into the industry, and there's a very big convention out in Las Vegas every year. And we went out to the first one. And when I was walking around there, I ran into a broker who I became friendly with. I told him what we were doing. I always made sure the brokers knew. I didn't pretend like we were newcomers. You know, I mean, I always kind of, we're experienced guys. We're looking for more to do. And the brokers wound up calling us a couple of weeks later and said, I have a small portfolio in the Hamptons. it's in your backyard. Would you like to do it? And I looked at, you know, I went out there. I said, the Hamptons, I'm worried about the fact that it's dependent on Wall Street. It's seasonal, you know, like all the kind of things you would think would be a problem with that market. And when I looked at the properties and I observed them through, because the owners of these properties had owned them for a number of years. So I got to see a little bit of a trend through some of the cycles. And as importantly, summer and winter, how they held up, and they were full all the time.
How far back you looked at, or just meaning what's your?
Well, in that case, I didn't have to look too far back because we had come out of a recent recession. But you know, generally, I'll look at 5 years if I can get it. Three, but 5 years gave me a very good indication. And then also, bottom line is in the Hamptons, you have very limited land. The zoning is impossible out there. I mean, they don't even like you building houses, forgetting about these ugly storage facilities. So the combination of a pretty consistent base of demands coupled with a limited amount of supply, and the fact that the guys who own these properties were local guys who weren't looking to maximize their profits. It was real. They built it and they had a lot of friends in these facilities. Billy Joel was in there and a bunch of other guys, and these guys were friendly with them. And so they never raised their rates. And so when I started looking at all these factors, I said, there's upside in these properties. And we beat out some REITs, actually, who were much more experienced than we were. But they were looking at these properties from Salt Lake City. And they were using metrics that they're used to. But they didn't realize how in the market these properties were. And we were fortunate to be able to get into contract on the first portfolio. And then when we went into contract, the other owners kind of said, oh, you guys are overpaying. Would you overpay for ours too? And we wound up getting a monopoly out there. And then we that was it.
That's very cool. Tell me something now. From storage to get to, you know, this whole arena of warehousing and industrial, tell us a little bit about this.
Well, there's a few steps in between. So,
okay.
Storage became a pretty big business. We wound up selling our portfolios. And this was now probably late. This was probably around 2005, 2006. And around that time, I started looking at the credit markets. And I started looking at what was going on with flipping of condos and easy credit. And seeing, you know, people with not a lot of money being able to go in and buy apartments with nothing down. And it just so happens a friend of mine who was a credit guy and I were talking, and he ran a big money management firm, and we both concluded, listen, we don't know what's going to happen here, but something bad's coming. We could never have predicted as bad as it was, but we wound up in 2006 deciding to do a fund, an opportunity fund, to take advantage of what was coming. And my friend had European pension funds as his clients. And we wound up doing the Dog and Pony Show over there, and we formed a fund, and we had commitments for $250 million. We raised and closed $50 million in June of 2008. In the fall of 2008, the world ended with Lehman and everything else collapsing. So we had $50 million to play with, and we wound up buying very opportunistically a bunch of properties. Interestingly, one of the first acquisitions we made was an art storage building on the east side of Manhattan. Kind of looking back to my roots in self-storage, art storage is a really interesting business. But I love the idea, again, that art storage, like our self-storage in the Hamptons, this particular facility was one of two in Midtown, so they had a monopoly. Nothing better in the real estate business than having monopolies, if you can do it. It's not easy. So we wound up buying that facility, and then we ran across town to the other guy who happened to be a distant relative of the guy on the east side. The families had fought 40 years ago and they split. And after a lot of effort, we wound up buying him too. So we wound up controlling Midtown Manhattan, the art storage business in Midtown Manhattan, with our fund money. And then we also wound up buying a big deal from Blackstone down in the Southeast mixed use project for pennies on the dollar. So this was 2008, 9, and 10, where we went through and accumulated and spent the money on those things. And then around 2011, I started thinking about, all right, we've just had a pretty tough number of years. What's the next thing that's going to happen? And if you really look back, when you come out of heavy recessions, usually multifamily leads the way for the reasons that you talked about before, is that people need a place to live. And so I started looking at multifamily at that time, based upon my historic perspective and where I thought things were gonna go. But what I decided to do, instead of going and looking in New York City or Los Angeles or any of the major gateway markets, we started looking at Southeast cities like Charlotte, like Greenville, because I felt that they were gonna be fast growing. So positive.
Interesting, positive, you saw it way before everybody else, basically. That's beautiful.
Right. So we started, so we made a decision.
How,
you'll appreciate this. 2012, I got presented, again, we willed our way into this business. Everything I've done is by an effort to will our way in, all right? Because if you don't push yourself in, no one's standing there opening the door. You have to break it down. So so how do you do that? Well, the way you start doing is you call brokers and you attend industry events. And you pretend like you've always been there, you know what I mean? Even though you haven't. And so we wound up getting a phone call from a broker that a major REIT was selling a couple of properties in Central Florida. The deal had dropped with another guy, and you have 2 weeks to move and get this thing done, right? And it was a $50 million deal. It wasn't tiny for guys who hadn't been in the business. Now, something that's important, because I want to freeze that for a second. It's very important as an entrepreneur in particular to always try to stay in touch with money. Even if you're not using it at that instant, you're always reaching out and talking to capital about what are you guys looking to do? Where do you want to deploy your capital? Even smaller guys can do this. And again, this is a whole nother lecture. We can talk about how you find money, but so when this opportunity hit, I had known that a hedge fund named Oxif was looking to put out money in unusual strategies. And I was very fortunate that they saw what I saw, which is we could buy these buildings, the best ones in town, at cap rates that were exceeding 7%, when the cost of debt, which is Fannie and Freddie, were the same as if I was buying a building in New York City, right? So we were borrowing at very strong rates. We were buying at 7.5 cap rates, and we were getting cash on cash returns, 14, 15, 16, right? So Oxif basically loved the strategy. I had gone to more conventional firms, and they said, no, we can't buy in the Southeast. We just got burned. You know, don't even talk to us about real estate. If we buy anything, we're buying something on 57th and 5th in New York City, so I can go into my investment committee and not look like a fool. But Oxif was a player. They're entrepreneurial, and they got it. So I was very fortunate that we had an arrangement with them. And we wound up buying that portfolio and another one in Louisville. So we probably bought over $100 million of properties with them. And this started leading to us getting into the business. And over a period of 3 years, maybe 3.5 years, we wound up buying 7,000 units, all Southeast kind of value add. So this takes me up to around 2015-16. And I started feeling that, or probably prematurely, because I've always been, I've never been on time with anything, but you know, I try to around the tips is, I'm either a little late or a little early, but that's okay. You never time things right. But I started seeing in 2015-16 the slow emergence of e-commerce. As I started studying this thing, I realized that what was coming with e-commerce was one of the greatest forces that we will see in our lifetime. And combined with that,
what was the thing you saw? Was it what everybody saw from Amazon coming, taking over the world and all that?
No, this is before Amazon Prime. This is, maybe it was around that time, but.
So what was Amazon, it?
What started really prompting my mind was seeing people, more and more people moving from Blackberries to iPhones and how prolific they were starting to become.
Wow, that's very.
I thought the statistic, I could be wrong, but I thought it was something like in 2008, maybe the penetration rate was 10% or so of, you know, people having smartphones. Today, it's like in the U.S., it's like 95%, 90%. So what that means is that people have in front of them a computer. What are they going to do with that, right? And so understanding what they're going to do with that, and then on top of this, obviously, Amazon, what changed the world in the most dramatic way possible is when Amazon issued Amazon Prime, where they're guaranteeing two-day delivery, right? That was the monumental moment in e-commerce, in my opinion. What really shook the world even more so was when they decided to go one day. Because one day now meant that you have to be on top of the population. Today, you could still be out in Ohio with a big distribution center, drive to, you know, Pennsylvania, stay overnight and get into the city the next day. When you're talking about one day, you got to be within proximity. If you want to deliver to major populations, you got to be close to the population. And so that led us, and I'm kind of mixing timing up here a little bit, but that really led us to a focus on, all right, there's going to be an increasing demand for buildings close to cities. How do we buy them? And what are we looking for? And where do we want to be? And that kind of prompted us to be, well, what's the most dense place on the earth in the United States is the East Coast. A third of the population of the U.S. is along the Eastern Seaboard. And so we started really going, what we did is, just to kind of go back, we wound up selling all our multi in 2016-17. We sold $500 million, all of it, out, done. We don't have any today. And we moved completely into industrial, all right? Because I felt at, and I don't know why sometimes I look back that I did these things, but I did them. But I really felt at the time, and I feel today even more so, that industrial, the change in industrial was the greatest force in any real estate sector that I had seen in my life and will be for the next 10 years. Nothing going to be like industrial and the shape it's going to continue to evolve into because it's changing all the time. And we can talk about that in a second. But we started and we were fortunate again, similar to when you asked the question early on, how do we do these kind of things when we weren't really in the business? Is we wound up sending the word out to our network of friends and people that we are now in the industrial business. And we got lucky that a intermediary young guy, actually based in San Francisco of all places, said, your timing is perfect. I just had a conversation with a large contractor based in the Southeast that has a property under control in Atlanta, and they don't know how to get the money for it. And they don't know how to do, they're not sophisticated players, they're builders. So we wound up hooking up with those guys as co-GPs. That package, piece of land that they had, million square foot buildable site in Atlanta in an incredible location, and then their resume in building them. And our resume is institutional investor. And I wound up bringing as our LP. And that package worked for Starwood because they had a sponsor that was unified. It had the institutional reporting and understanding, which was us, and it had the actual hands-on go-to guys who've done this for 30 years. And we melded that together, and that's all my doing by presenting a package that made sense. And on that deal, which was a million square feet, Wharton itself started learning how to build these buildings. What goes into these buildings? What are the thought process around industrial? And that particular partnership went on and built about 3-4 million square feet together with the likes of Carlyle and other large institutions. And we sold in a really very fortunate timing last year, towards the end of the year, a lot of that at very low cap rates. And then we started shifting to the East Coast and at last mile properties.
Tell me something, when you talk about those industrial, when you talk about especially development, and we talk about where the market is going in a second, but when you have to learn to shift the development, I would say, expertise, what is different? What do you have to look at when you see industrial, when you're looking in a warehouse? What is the first thing you look at?
The first thing you got to think about, okay, this is a good question and it's a relevant question. The first thing you need to think about is who is your tenant? If the building's not leased, but even if it is leased, is this a tenant that was unique, that he had to be there because it was next to something, or is the owner lived around the corner? So first and foremost, who are your tenants and who will be your tenants? That's the first thing. The second thing you want to look at is this building flexible enough to have a wide array of possible users? And does it have the features that those users are going to want to have? So is there enough loading? Is there enough employee parking? Are the ceiling heights high enough? It's very, very, it's not difficult. This is not any.
So let me ask you a pretty difficult question on that one. One of the things, I had a conversation with one of very big retailers in the past. We tried to do something together. And I remember him very well because I learned a lot from the way he looked at things, looked at deals. And the one thing he looked at, I asked him, why not go for warehouse? That was pretty much at the time when Amazon came in very quickly, very fast. And he said, I'm not going to put all my efforts on finding, repositioning, building, developing, whatever, a warehouse for a company like that, whether it's Amazon or similar, it doesn't matter. Because once I do that, it's going to be a very build-to-suit type of an experience, right? Which will be tailored to their needs, just like you have described right now. And I don't want to get stuck with that property with not being able to move it forward to anything else or reposition it or change it. What is your take on that?
Most buildings, depending upon what you're talking about, right? If you're talking about a 500,000 square foot distribution facility in Orange County, right? First of all, those buildings are built, so they're largely generic. Might the inhabitants have special offices, or might they may have assembly lines that are installed, but those things could be changed. The structure itself pretty much is common. Now, where this becomes more of a problem is if you get involved with something like cold storage, which is an area that we're very focused on, because in cold storage, you really are building those buildings to meet the demand of the particular tenants. And that could shift dramatically from one tenant to another, right? Do they need refrigerated? Do they need freezer? Do they need, how high the ceilings? And so when you start getting into special built situations, that's when it becomes an issue. But on a generic warehouse, it's not an issue at all. Because also remember when you asked that question, and I don't know how long ago it was, but the amount of users that are looking for space today is far outweighs the supply. So while that would they love to have gold faucets, maybe they would like gold faucets, but they'll take silver because they don't have a choice. Right?
Right.
So it's all about location, as always in real estate. But more so today, location, location, location is probably most prevalent today, most important for industrial than it is even for things like self-storage, because self-storage today is done through your phone, mostly. People are surfing and they're saying, oh, these guys are cheap and they have good reviews. They don't care if it's tucked in behind, a museum somewhere and you can't see it from the highway. They used to care because before the internet, it was all about, oh, I see that building. There's a self-storage building there. Let's go rent. It's not as important. What's important today in industrial is proximity to the highways, if it's a distribution facility, and then also if you're thinking about something that's really infill is, am I going through residential areas? Like, what's the traffic look like? What's the taxes look like?
Yeah, right. There are many aspects, of course.
That's not an issue, really, of retrofitting.
Okay, that's a great answer. I love that. I love that answer. Mm-hmm. Tell me something. Mm-hmm. Big question. Nobody has a crystal ball, but what do you see? What's coming up our way post-COVID?
I think the most dramatic change that you're going to see over the next 3, 4, 5 years is going to be in industrial. It's going to be robotics. You're going to see more and more of simple robots starting in warehouses. There was something on CNBC yesterday, a firm out of Boston that introduced a robot which will take packages out of trailers that kind of pull up the buildings. And instead of in sweltering heat during the summer, you have labor guys going in there, and now you're going to see robots go in, pull the packages out, and bring them into the warehouse. So I think that automation is going to be a really big part going forward. And I think 5 to 7 years, I think automated vehicles are going to be a crucially important change in the way goods are distributed. And that could be as simple as just small Sprinter vans going through New York City. And instead of having people sitting in those cars as they go over the 59th Street Bridge, you have the cars themselves. And it's going to just change the way we live our lives. What happens with those vans? They go in, how do those goods get unloaded, right? Think about that. It's nice that you got there. Now what happens? So I see some things changing, which automation is going to be a very big part of. There is a company called Fabric, like clothing, that we are close to. That's actually big, out of Israel. Interesting guys that formed robots that are for what's called micro fulfillment centers. So these are 10 to 15,000 square foot properties next to big cities that are fully automated. And they're the ones who have the robots inside there.
Incredible.
Robots go, they go, there's actually a few in Israel, one in Tel Aviv and a couple around with some of the large drug chains and a grocery store. But these robots go vertically, horizontally. So I think automation is going to be a really big factor going forward. I think you're going to see more and more cold storage, and the solutions for cold storage are going to be important. So I think you'll see more and more less mild cold storage facilities than you have in the past. Today, basically cold storage has traditionally been a business of big bulk warehouses. And I think you're going to need different solutions going forward because of the direct-to-consumer. You're going to see more and more ghost kitchens pop up. I saw the other day, which is really fascinating, a lot of restaurant chains and others, food companies are developing brands. I don't exactly remember the term, but they're developing their own brands. One of the chains has an incredible fried Oreo cookie, something. There's a company that's doing a certain type of wings, chicken wings. It's a major brand. It's a brand you know. But they've labeled it something else. And they're making these chicken wings in the kitchen. It's not part of the restaurant, it's somewhere else. And they're going direct to consumer. So this whole concept of food and the evolution of food and the distribution of food and the preparation of food, we're in the second inning of a nine inning, maybe a double header. So I think food is gonna be a really fascinating game going forward. But the most interesting thing in industrial is it's really indicative of the world ahead, which is going to be powered by technology. What's happening with technology, and particularly artificial intelligence and machine learning and some of these other things, are going to speed the pace of innovation at a rate that we've never seen before. And so with that change, which would have taken 25 years and it takes 2 years, right? The world is changing so fast. And so in that, you don't have to go too far. Look at any news show on TV and see what's happening today with SPACs and with, the valuations that companies like Robinhood are getting, And so I'll give you another example of something quickly, which is something that the guys should think about out there. You look at a company like Robinhood, right? Robinhood has basically enabled millennials to play online. And in many regards, because of Reddit and what's happening with things like GameStop, et cetera, they're gambling. All right. So, but most importantly, what the lesson you learn from this is we are moving into an era now where investments are going to be done more and more online, more and more by people who are going to be the actual buyer. So they're going to avoid the intermediary. And you're going to see, which what Robinhood was a pioneer in, is the ability to buy a fractional interest in Apple stock because they can't afford $150, right? So they could buy for $5 a small fraction of the stock, which was never before. You can only buy in lots in the past. So what's going to happen, and it's already happening in crowdfunding, and this is an overflow of what's going to happen at large with fundraising in the future, you're going to see real estate more and more become crowdfunding friendly. So while the business has been around for a while, this crowdfunding business, we're now moving into overdrive because of things like Robinhood. And I think over the next 10, 15 years, you're going to see lots and lots and lots of money be raised through the internet, through intermediaries like Realty Mogul and CrowdStreet and some of these other guys. And that's an area that we're very focused on as far as our capital raising.
Interesting, because that's pretty much the answer. When people ask me, why are you so psyched about prop tech? You know, it's pretty much what I answer them. And that's very good. I want to just shift gears because we are running towards the end. If a quick answer on that one, what is your take on when you and your fund, when you get into a deal and acquisition, what's your hold period? Meaning, when you look at a deal from the beginning, meaning obviously you never know how many years you're going to hold a deal, but when you enter a deal, what do you look at? How many years?
Well,
5, 7, 10, 20.
Yeah, whatever you think you're going to do, you never do it. So it's all hypothetical. Shifting is a firm. And that is because a lot of our business has been powered by capital that was opportunity fund driven. You were almost required to sell 3 years hence, let's say, sometimes earlier, sometimes a little later, but never really had a long-term view because the money has to get recycled. We're now taking things more into our hands. That's why I like crowdfunding. That's why we just raised a small fund where we control. And so what I want to do and what we're going to do is we're going to buy lots of assets and we're going to prune the assets that we want to get rid of, either because someone's willing to overpay or we don't think it's in a great spot, but yet the market, and try to retain the other assets and hold those longer term. In industrial in particular, I think we're early.
I love
in
that strategy. Yeah.
We're early in the game, potentially on rental rates running. And so I think you leave money on the table if you exit some of these properties too early. But also, really, if you think about the great wealth that's accumulated in real estate, it's over time,
right?
Not by flipping things.
What I want to ask you, a totally different question. I want to shift gears just a little bit before we close. Early, you spoke about how you got in and that you went to a lot of events and you met a lot of brokers and you made sure that they understand that you are a player in the game. And that's how you got in. And the events were a big player. Today, events, you know what they are. Virtual events are there, and they're very strong and working well, but they're not nearly the same as the live events where you go and network and you talk to a person, you create close relationship where you can make something done, get something done. What would be your tip to all those people who are getting in today, where you were then? How can they create a relationship while, the world is still where it is?
Well, how did you get to me?
I got to you through LinkedIn. But I'll tell you what the difference is. It is a point, but I'll tell you what the difference is. I'm in a different place. Okay. Let's talk about the someone who's getting in fresh, new, wants to start, no experience, zero, nothing, and doesn't have that confidence yet to approach someone on LinkedIn and on the personal basis they would.
Well, all right. First of all, the bottom line is you have to have some level of confidence and you have to be willing to get rejection. So what someone should be doing is they should be zeroing on whatever area they're in. If their mortgage brokers is one thing, if their principals is another, multifamily, figure out who you are and then get into as many different types of chat groups or organizations online, and also surf as far as the LinkedIn guys, even if they're senior. You know, these guys will return they'll mostly reply yes. And so don't be afraid of reaching out to the head of Goldman Sachs' real estate group if you're 22 years old. They will either respond or they won't, but okay, if they don't respond, who cares? But I think the key, as I mentioned before, is you got to continue to expand your universe. So nothing replaces personal interactions, and they will come back. All right. We're not done with that as a society, I promise you. Right. So, but in the interim, what you can do, and when you reach someone or you're making an appeal to someone, you should say something like, I see a lot of deal flow. Like what do you want from them? Right. And you got to be realistic. The head of Goldman Sachs is dealing with multi-billion-dollar transactions. Maybe that's not a great example, but there are a whole bunch of other guys. Maybe within Goldman Sachs, you go after a VP level guy that's looking to move up. And so he needs deals. He wants to show his bosses that he can produce, assets. So you go after this guy. What does he want to hear from a 22-year-old, 24-year-old, 25-year-old? I have deal flow through my family or friends or otherwise. And, you know, I'm just reaching out to find out what you guys are interested in doing. Again, Goldman may be a bad example, but there are many, many kind of middle market companies out there that provide capital. If in fact, let's say you were looking for capital, where you could go after these guys and start talking to them and just become obsessed with it. Again, everything I've done in my life is obsession. It's not a casual observation. You got to get the mindset around what do you want to accomplish? And then you have to become obsessed with accomplishing it. And then somehow, some way, you will your way into it and you do it. Exactly. We're not, this is another discussion another time, but we don't even talk about the venture capital business that we have, which is very successful. Again, guys will say, what do you know about venture capital? And the bottom line is, I have enough instincts to tell me when the company is in a good spot and it's a good company. And I have enough brain power to figure out who can help us determine whether or not that company will make it. And sometimes it may be technical, if it's an algorithm or something that we need to understand, or other guys who are in the business. But the bottom line is, it all starts with an obsession of finding the answer. And when you can't sleep and when you're completely consumed by it, the answers come to you. But you have to be in the mindset to make it happen, or else you'll be relegated to becoming a specialist in one thing, and over time, which is not bad. And I wouldn't criticize that approach. But if you want to be eclectic, you have to have that certain type of approach to business.
So first of all, Peter, thank you. And I just want to tell everybody who's listening, basically, that as you could see, you have to, I always say that, whatever show I have, if it's my guests, you have to be relentless. You have to not be embarrassed by approaching people and actually get them. And if today you can't go and meet them in person, you have to go online and meet them there and say, I'm here. I want to be a part of this. I want to get to know you, et cetera, et cetera.
And be also, respectful and be nice.
Exactly. And be respectful and nice.
You know what I mean? Like, don't forget about being a good person. People love good people. Be courteous.
100%.
And something else I'll give the guys a little tip on, I talk about this when I preach at some of the schools I mentor, is there's nothing wrong. The offices today make this harder, but when we go back to work, there's nothing wrong with sending a written note. Everyone sends, and everyone will send, in the minimum, you have to send a thank you via email. I get it. But if you want to really stand out, send them a note. No one does it. That emails get lost in the letter. A note, simple, is something, and that guy will then sit there and say, this kid took the time out, or this woman, or you got, whatever age they're at, to think about this. So think about things, and this is consistent with contrarian investing and contrarian viewpoint, is think about things that others aren't doing And if you go the route of not doing what everyone else, what everyone else is doing, how will it be received? Right? And you'll find most times, as long as you're not a bad person, it's going to come out in your favor. So in this world where everything's crowded, where everything's digital, where everyone's busy, where be thoughtful about how you communicate with other people. Because over time, you'll develop a base of goodwill that you'll be able to, at some point in time, you'll be able to call on, you know what I mean, from people. And that's been a big thing for us too, is I've always instilled in the firm to be thoughtful. We have a career of 40 years almost, haven't been sued. Because if we're in a situation where we're entering to something that's contentious, is we approach it head on. And we desperately try to make sure that we can solve it, even if sometimes it's not in our best interest as far as money or otherwise, because you want to live a life that's wholesome, that's happy, that's got good karma. This is nothing different than I'm sure you studied, obviously, deeply, earlier in your life. But it always comes down to being really loving and thoughtful to other people and genuine. It does. It really does. And it comes back to you 100 times, and do things. Don't do things. Look at don't always look for something in return. Do it because you're a nice person. You'll get it back 100 times. You will.
100%. Be genuine. Jay. Be real, not fake. Do it from your heart. There's a saying, there's a saying, it's a worldly saying, but the rabbis also say, the sages say, whatever comes out of the heart comes into the heart, you know?
Yeah.
Meaning it comes from your heart, it gets into the heart. And that's
very wise.
And that's how it works. And I want to tell everybody, Peter, really thank you for your time. And I want to tell everybody, we took today, if you listen very carefully to this interview today, to this show today, you guys have so many things to take from. Even if you're a veteran, and I learned a lot, definitely, and we can definitely see where the world is going with tech, with robotics, how warehousing is going to be affected, and how to look at deals and how to maneuver and shift from asset class between asset classes. I think that's an art that we learned from Peter, and that's something to take on. If you're a beginner, you could take on this relentless attitude, and the attitude of being, first of all, being a person, and to reach out and to see how to make connections, and how do you say, never stop, never give up, never stop, keep on going. And that's beautiful. It. And Peter, I really thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
Stick around before we stop the recording. I just want to tell everybody, thank you so much for watching the show. And please make sure that you like, you share, you put all the 5 stars wherever platform you're listening to or you're looking at. Do whatever you need to do. And guys, I'm going to see you next time. Take care.
Thank you.
Hey guys, thanks for joining me in this CRE Shark Eye show. I hope you enjoyed it. And go subscribe, download, do whatever you guys need to do. And I'll see you in the next episode. Take care of yourselves.